the next, I think, five sessions, we'll be exploring the four foundations of mindfulness, which is some of you, how many people are familiar with that? Okay, yep, so a bunch of you, but that's okay. Let's see what we learn. And it just seems really worth exploring that and seeing what comes up. These are the instructions the Buddha gave for how to do this practice. And it's just this amazing subject that we keep learning more about. I mean, if we had it, we'd be awakened. So, you know, since we don't yet, I bet there's stuff for us to deepen in about that. Certainly is for me. And thank
Steve,
you.
Sorry. Yeah. Can you turn the camera on to you?
Oh, yeah. Thank you. Thank you. The dark version of me.
Thanks.
And so the Buddha taught this in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is number 10 in the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. And it's just 15 pages, the Satipatthana Sutta, but it's generated these two books, for starters, and I got two more at home I didn't bring. So, you know, these mere 15 pages, there's so much depth in there that people, brilliant people like Anilayo and Joseph Goldstein, have written brilliant books about them. And it's an amazing area. This is a place, you know, arguably more than anywhere else in the suttas where the Buddha really, really taught how to do this practice. So we're going to go through it kind of gradually. And I'm trying to always keep in mind that some people may or may not be here on different evenings. So for one thing, it's recorded and goes up. But for another thing, each one kind of stands alone. You know, it's all kind of holographic. So whatever you're here for, it's good. And you can get access in all kinds of other places. But Joseph also did, by the way, there's a 46-part audio series on Dharma Seed on the Satipatthana Sutta. Yep, 46, yeah. It's amazing. And it sort of became this book. But nonetheless, there you go. So, and I've taught this a bunch of times over the years because it always seems just so worthwhile. And if we don't do it, then we should be every once in a while, you know, because it's the bedrock. So I wanted to do that. And, you know, I do it kind of differently because my own sense of things just keeps evolving. And a lot of times I look back on something I say, ooh, you know, because I kind of realized maybe not or not so much or something. So although I try to, you know, ground myself in texts and things. So for this first evening, I want to share with you four aspects of the sutta that kind of set up the actual four foundations. So this isn't about the four foundations per se, but there's two in the kind of preamble in the sutta. There's one that repeats one aspect, and then there's one at the end. And I think framing it with those is helpful to know what this is about. And the four, the four of these are, okay, let's do it that way. The four of these are the direct path that describes what the sutta offers, the definition, which describes attitudes to take doing the practice, the refrain, which is repeated 13 times, that describes how it works, and then what you might call the prediction or the promise at the end, where the Buddha talks about what you can expect from doing this. And this is like unique, and I mean, if the suttas were all in a book, it'd be about this thick. There's four Nikayas and there's thousands of pages. These are unique because there's no place else where it's so specific and prescriptive about how to practice and what it'll do. And any of these can make a big difference in your life, these four aspects. I mean, any of them can really help your practice. So be interested to see what lands for y'all. You know, and it evolves. And I should say that the four foundations themselves has to do with the breadth of what that which we are aware of or that which we are cultivating mindfulness of. And in brief, it's body and this funny term vedanas, which has to do with whether we experience things as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And the third one has to do with states of mind. And the fourth one, which is dhammas, has to do with sometimes translated as mind objects. So just throwing out, that's the next 4 weeks. But this first idea of the direct path of the practice, and it's really interesting. This is where he sort of proclaims what this is, the Buddha does, in this very powerful way. And it's interesting because, you know, many of our brothers and sisters in other religions, they say, oh, this is the only way. You know, they're really adamant about that. Theirs is the right way and others are the wrong way. And the Buddha's not saying that. He's just saying this is a direct way. You know, this is an efficacious way. It's not, there's no right or wrong there. But he really emphasizes. And it's helpful when we're doing this practice because it seems so simple. You know, mindfulness practice, be aware moment by moment of what's arising and passing. That's it. You know, but this really works. He's really emphasizing this will take us there to awakening, which is the whole point. So it has to do with efficacy. And I read from the suttas a little bit. So he says, monks, this is the direct path for the purification of beings, for the surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of dukkha and discontent, for acquiring the true method for the realization of nibbana, namely the four satipatthanas. So he's pointing right at nibbana, right at awakening. You know, so it's not just being mindful to be mindful, but pointing right at what the Buddha embodied. So it's so amazing in that way. And it's pretty powerful. You know, how to be free ultimately. But he doesn't say this is the only path. And as we know, many of us, Buddhism is full of different approaches to the same goal. But this is this very succinct, elemental path that we can just work. It's in our hands. It's in who we are. And these four foundations are effective. And so I wanted to understand. It's so weird. It's up there. You read it. It's so creepy. I wish I could figure a way to not be that way. Do you find it helpful? I am the same way. Okay, that's good. No. No, that's okay. It's not rude at all. Do what you got to do. No, it's fine. It's all good. So I'm like that too. I'm more of a reader than a listener. But that's why I've always been interested in the sutta, because that's why I do this, you know, is to awaken. And how far can I get in this lifetime? And so I've just been fascinated with how this thing keeps unpacking. Every time I go around, I keep seeing new things. It's crazy, 15 pages. And notice the pattern in what he said. He talks about four difficulties, sorrow and lamentation, dukkha and discontent, and then he offers one solution, which is nibbana. So it's the complete letting go of attachment, the complete not clinging. And this practice will get you there. So he's offering us a way to achieve what he did. And as we know, in 2,600 years, many, many, many people have awakened in that way. That's part of why this tradition has stayed alive, because there's a whole legacy of this working for people. And this doesn't, you know, it starts with the grit and pain of the world. It starts with how things are and then rolls out of there. So it's not like this, you know, this thing we have to have faith in, but rather just here we are, we can be free. Carl Jung addresses, I love this quote, he says, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. And in a sense, that's what we're doing in our practice, is making the darkness conscious. So the second of these four is the definition. It's a very brief section, but it's sort of a preview, and he sort of defines how to do the practice. And it does name the four subjects or foundations. I forgot that it was here. Mindfulness of body, mindfulness of Vedanas, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral mind, and Dhammas. It names them there right at the beginning. But what the Buddha does is he tells us how to approach these. Because later on we'll be talking about the distinctions, the specific characteristics of the four. But here he's talking about how to approach them all. How to hold our practice, how to lean in to our practice. So this is actually it's actually really important. And it's this tiny little phrase. He says, to do this practice, ardent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in the world. That's it. Ardent, clearly knowing and mindful, free from desires and discontent in the world. And this phrase for me, like I do a lot of self-retreat, and this has kept me on track often, like ardent, especially like, am I ardent? Am I doing ardent? You know, just to crank it up, because it's easy to kind of space out. Or a friend of mine said, what do they say? If you, on long self-retreat, any one of three things happens. You become awakened, you go nuts, or you start a hobby. You know, like whittling little horses out of walnut shells or something. So ardent really keeps you on track.
What is that word? I'm sorry.
Ardent, A-R-D-E-N-T is the English word, but I'll talk about where it comes from. Because,
okay.
Yeah, no, exactly.
Ardent, yeah.
Yep, ardent is the English word. So translators have a field day, as always, trying to get the Pali into English that somehow means what the Buddha intended. And so this is very interesting. So the ardent, the word ardent, that's like, you know, when you sit down to practice, like what do you do in the morning, whatever, when you sit down to practice, you know, if we're kind of on cruise control, that's not ardent. If we're just sort of, oh, here I am again, that's not the fire that will actually make it turn the wheel. So there's really something to take into our hearts there. How much do we hold the intensity of this life and death question, you know, because we have this short life, we're going to die. What do we do with this short life we got? Especially if there's this amazing possibility and we whiff it, you know? So that could, it's kind of like standing on the edge of a cliff, you know? That's kind of ardent, like you're going to step forward. What you're going to do, you know, with the cliff edge? We're kind of, actually, that's kind of how life is. And think of the Buddha's life, you know? He let go of wealth and power that most people struggle to attain and nearly starved himself to death during the ascetic phase when he thought that was the way. And he never gave up. So the word that's translated as ardent and sometimes diligent is atapi, which is related to the Sanskrit word tapas. And I kind of this all rang a bell for me from my former yogic phrase, because that tapas is as connotations of spiritual discipline, the heat and passion of spiritual discipline. So it really has a subtext there of how to approach this with that kind of fire. You know, think of Hindu yogis meditating on bends of nails or holding their arms up over their heads for 12 years. You know, there's some fire that, whatever you think about that practice, that makes them do that because they're searching for something. So it's this real sense of power and turning one's will toward it, this ardent enthusiasm, if you will, but with some fire behind it. My very first teacher was a Tibetan Lama, Venerable Gyalma Rinpa, and he had that kind of intensity. He actually, I mean, it's, you know, you think, oh, it sort of seems like, oh, lamas, they do what lamas do. But he actually was, he was on a track to become a Geshe, which in that time meant he would have then had a position in a big monastery. And right at the end, he blew it off and went out to practice in caves. He just said, no, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to be in a big monastery with administrative duties. So he was just a fierce practitioner. He was amazing. And he said, we should practice like our hair's on fire. This is something that, you know, he didn't mess around. So to me, you know, I think this word ardent is a real fire starter in practice. And, you know, when personally, if I'm feeling a little slack, I'll check on that. You know, that's what the Buddha said, to approach it with ardency. And during long retreat, I know you've done a long retreat, to be able to, and if you want to say anything, say it, to be able to turn one's intention, because there's no structure. It's up to a person, one's own person, to do it. And so unless you have to find that somewhere, you know, you have to be clear about where you're going, why you're doing it, why you're even here, going through all this ridiculous stuff that isn't so much fun, and find that fire. So it is pivotal. It's pivotal, and that's why it's so powerful that he said that. I don't know if you, I won't. At the end, we'll talk. Okay, the second word, got it? The second word, translated as clearly comprehending, is also really fascinating. The word is sampajana, And the intent here is that we understand the actual meaning of things. You know, mindfulness is about being aware moment by moment. Sampajana is how we see. It's where it takes us that we actually see how things are. And this is really powerful because it's not about faith or supposition or speculation how the path works. It's about seeing. We can do that. This can get us to a place where we just directly see the nature of reality. So that is so, you know, extraordinary to know that that is in our power. And, you know, I'm not making this up. You take a look at highly awakened beings and like, whoa, they see clearly. It's pretty amazing. Pretty amazing. I mean, even like, well, someone like Joseph Goldstein, you know, he's one of the most deeply practiced Westerners that we have. And you get the sense when you're around him, he's so articulate. He's trying to explain things to him are completely obvious about how things are. He's very patient with us. And he's just trying to explain what is totally obvious because he sees really clearly. I'm sure it was similar with Goenka. Goenkaji. Yeah, yeah.
I think Robin Smith,
too. He does have that quality. I think you're right. Exactly. Yep, yep. And so this also is a sense of direction, you know. It's part of why I'm bringing this all up, because this is sort of the prelude to the four foundations. And to keep checking on ardency to know that this whole sense of sampajana is where we're heading is really helpful. And then the third one is how to do this. And the Buddha gives the answer with the third word, mindful. Mindfulness. Sati is the Pali word. And it's got this quality of remembering in it. It's very interesting. I'm still working on that. But it's like, partly it's remembering to be aware, but it's also like, remembering means like being aware moment by moment of what's happening, not forgetting it, just being right with it as it happens. So sati is really interesting, and that is that practice, this mindfulness practice that we do, which is all linked up with how it's at the core of how this practice works. So put them together, the three words, and it's kind of like a road, you know, yellow brick road, a sign, go this way. Ardent, clearly comprehending, and mindful. You might just try it out in your practice, you know? Just check it out in the morning. Run that by. You know, it's good sometimes you practice to do a little, like, give yourself a little minute Dharma talk. Why am I doing this? What am I doing exactly? You know, oh yeah, I gotta pay attention, feel my breath. Why? Oh, to awaken. Just, because otherwise you can kind of, 20 minutes later, you're still planning your car repair. I mean, I'm not certain. Okay. So the next of the four sections I wanted to discuss is what's called the refrain, which is really interesting. It's repeated 13 times in various forms through the sutta, but it's where the Buddha explains how the practice works, what it is about mindfulness practice that helps us. Why are we doing it? How does it help us be free? And it's worthwhile talking about the repetition and getting in under the hood there, because since later on one looks at the differences in the 13 repetitions, you can lose track of the essence that's common through all of them. So it's kind of worthwhile to look at the essence for a minute before we look at the 13 later on. And as usual, just some code here, but they all follow the same pattern. So where the Buddha says a meditator, hang on a second. Okay, there's different parts of it. For different parts of the 13 that are interesting. For one thing, the Buddha says that a meditator abides contemplating in terms of body internally or contemplating externally. And this is a duality, internally and externally, that's repeated through all 13. And it's really interesting. It's really important. You can kind of gloss over that easy because we think, oh, I'm meditating, you know, internal. What's the external about? But it's actually really helpful in life in many, many ways. It's really important to realize that we're actually being mindful of everything that's going through the sense doors. And some of it's internal and some of it's external. And some of it is in other moments of life, like, you know, school or a difficult meeting. Being mindful externally can happen there, internally and externally. What's going on inside of me in a difficult meeting? What's going on with other folks around me in a difficult meeting? So to be mindful in all those arenas simultaneously is kind of how we walk through life. Because it's not just sitting cross-legged in the quiet room, these four foundations. It's how we get through life. So, you know, one aspect of that is, especially for those of you who've been on long retreat, you know, you're sitting wanting to practice and it's all good, except for the person next to you. They snore or they breathe really funny and you just get so, it's like, oh God, if only I was sitting, if I wasn't sitting next to them, everything would be great. You've had that experience? Yeah. So. Yeah. So there's something to learn there, right? Yeah, exactly. Oh, man. So there's something to learn there because it really is a place to be mindful. I mean, that's the deal, you know? That's just how the decks got, the cards got shuffled. And that's the deal, and to really remember, yep, right there, got to do it there. And to actually get over that hump where that's fine. Oh, it's just fine that heavy breathing person that's next to me is okay because I'm aware of it. I'm aware of what's going on. It's really, really helpful because otherwise we're looking for the perfect moment in order for our practice to be good. And that, forget it, you know. I mean, we may have a quiet room once in a while, but we'll come up with something to fill it anyway. So there are no perfect moments. There's this moment. That's the perfect moment, whatever happens to be going on. Yeah, there's nowhere we can get stuck. You know, anything we think is something irritating externally, it doesn't make any sense to get stuck there. We can't. And also, it really seems to me that this really pulls us in the direction of compassion, because listening externally is part of how we really hear people. You know, we hear people because when we listen internally, when we're mindful internally, we kind of unpack our complexities. You know, the very thing that's a pain in the butt sometimes, practicing where all of our thoughts and our backed up emotions and our longings and yearnings and mistakes come up. And it seems like, oh, all wrong, but actually that's how we're untangling our tangles. That also happens externally. You know, especially think about someone you're really close to, the person like your loved person close in your life, your family. The more you tune in and listen, you start to understand what's going on in them that makes them act the difficult way they act when they think we're being difficult, which of course may not be true. I know. No, is she there again? Oh, yeah, that's so great. But no, it's true. I mean, it's true. I've been married 32 years. Yeah, and I get it. You know, but to really, really listen, it's such an act of compassion, because that's how we can really, really hear the other. And it just transcends personality and differences. It's pretty amazing. So I think externally and internally and externally, the more I've looked at it, I've just said, this is so important. It just broadens the practice out and brings heart into it, because, you know, our human circumstance is, in fact, most of where we spend our lives, is rubbing up against, for better or for worse, the other human beings around us. And I really think that intuition happens out of that. You know, we have intuition internally where we see. You ever have that? You know, you see this place that was stuck in you. And there's an opening. We can do that externally too with the people close to us. We see. Or the place where we're stuck, we see. But we have to bring mindfulness to that. Because otherwise, you know, sometimes couples who've been around for decades and decades, they can get bitter if they don't do that, if they don't see. Then they get lodged in what this person did wrong, this person's this, and point, 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 and there's no solution, there's no freeing. So it's so important, externally, mindful. And then the second key phrase that's in all the refrains tells us what we're doing in practice. It says, and this is from the body section, and forgive me for the male gender, but it says, he abides contemplating the nature of arising in the body, or he abides contemplating the nature of passing in the body. That's what takes us to seeing impermanence. You know? And in our practice, you know, look at what goes on in our practice. You know, our breath appears and disappears, and especially thoughts, they appear, and if we're mindful, they disappear sooner or later. Or emotions, the whole thing, everything appears and disappears, appears and disappears. And some of you know the three characteristics: impermanence, not self, and suffering. That's how we're seeing it, just from contemplating the nature of arising in the body or in the mind, and the nature of passing in the body or in the mind. That's the core of how this unplugs us from clinging, because it's all changing. You know, what's there to be stuck on, and who is there to be stuck on it, is sort of what we start to gradually see. And in the way we see insight, usually impermanence comes first. That's what we start to see, the rising and passing. And then from that, we start to see, oh, this thing, this me that I cling to and love and cherish so much, where is it? It's just a bunch of arising and passings, and it starts to fall apart. It starts to deconstruct. And then we see not self from that. And then from that, you know, we see dukkha, because people clinging, when we clung, that's dukkha. When we let go, that solves it. So the nature of passing. This great Tibetan master Longchenpa said, all inner phenomena are like the traces left by a bird flying in the sky, manifesting as mental stirrings, yet fading naturally from one's awareness. You know, so that's another way of stating impermanence. So this seeing this and this refrain, this contemplating, this arising and passing, it applies to everything. And what he says, the result of this, it says, she abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That's what it says 13 times. She abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. And that's where it takes us. And I got to say, for me, this like not clinging, that seemed kind of mundane for a long time. Like, really, that's it? You know, really, that's all? But then the more you look at it, and the more you realize actually clinging is it. That's our trip up. That's where we get stuck. And not clinging is unbelievably profound. The more we see what not clinging is, the freer it becomes. So it's pretty amazing. So this refrain, 13 times, says how it works. And as we'll see in the coming weeks, it goes through the entire spectrum of everything we experience, internally and externally, in mind and body. Watch it arise, watch it go away, realize it's not us, takes us toward not clinging. But what the Buddha does, he just lays it out, and he lays out some areas that we don't even, that are going on, that we're not even aware they're going on. So he helps us point to things to be aware of that are impermanent, that we think are permanent without realizing we're even thinking that. And, you know, he talks about worldly life. That's kind of how a lot of us, most of us, we live. We all live worldly life in one way or another. But, you know, I was looking at this picture of Jeff Bezos recently, and it's just like, oh, my God, I don't know what to think. I mean, I'm a little embarrassed here, but he has this female partner, which is fine, but she's just like almost like a caricature of an incredibly beautiful female partner, which is great, but it seems so, and he has this 400-foot yacht, which is fine, and it does have sails, which I appreciate, but it just seems so fragile, you know? I mean, what if the beautiful female partner is 20 years later? Was that still going to work? I don't know. You know, what's it really about, and the yacht, and I don't know. It just seems so fragile. It's like, it's almost like a caricature of clinging, putting all that energy into building a 400-foot yacht and hoping it won't be destroyed tomorrow. He probably hopes it won't, I think. I don't think he cares. It took 5 years to build it. Okay. But still. Yes. Okay. I think on some level he probably cares. But I know what you mean. I know what you mean. Okay. So what this means to me, this refrain, is that just because it's so accessible, that it really suggests to us that this freedom of practice that he's pointing to is something we can do step by step in every little facet of what we would cling to or what emerges in our practice. And then the fourth section I wanted to touch on is the very amazing prediction or promise about the result of this practice. And as far as I know, I don't think this shows up anywhere else in the suttas except for here, where he basically says, he promises that this mindfulness practice will bear fruit. And also he tells us how long it's going to take, which is really interesting. He says, if anyone should develop these four satipatthanas in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected, either final knowledge here and now, nibbana, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-returning, which means after you die, you won't come back to this plane, you'll continue in another. So 7 years, we're good, he says, if you really do it, he says. And 7 years is kind of long, but that's okay. But then he cranks it up. And he says, well, actually, 6 years. And he says, 5 years. And then down to 1 year. He keeps on doing this repeating thing. Then it goes from months, from 12 months to one, and then goes down to 7 days. If you do it for 7 days, he says, that's really interesting. So that kind of, it almost brings it full circle. It's like it brings us back to ardency. It brings us back to what we really do. Because in the time of the Buddha, there's all kinds of people who just heard, you know, heard one mention of what impermanent was and they woke up. They perhaps were carrying less baggage than at least moi. I don't know about y'all, you know, but it's not so easy. But nonetheless, it's a breath away at the same time. 7 years, 7 days, we don't know, but tactile, doable, very powerful. So I think that's what I got to share right now. Maybe we could just sit for a moment.